good afternoon, whenever you happen to be listening to me. Welcome to Season 1 of Patriot to the Core. I am Thad Forster, and I appreciate you tuning in. I'm looking forward to introducing the guest today, who is a good friend of mine, Michael Andrew. Mike is a unique individual. We'll want to talk about some of his business failures, what he does as a profession lightly, but most importantly, really what he does to serve others. He's a great humanitarian. He travels the world responding to natural disasters, and he's been to multiple locations around the globe. I think his volunteer work of this capacity started as when he lived in Alabama, which is where we met, and we went and did some service in response to Hurricanes Ivan and Katrina and maybe some other storms that happened to have come through over the years that he lived in Tuscaloosa. So, Mike, it's great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing, Thad?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm okay. Good to hear from you. It's been a while since we've talked.
It has been, yeah. We are, you know, for being such good friends, we don't get to see each other much, but you're all the way in Hawaii and in Maui, and I'm here in Alabama, so that kind of makes things a little difficult.
Time zones have messed up many relationships for me with many different people. You know, I think you're 5 hours ahead of me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think you've got a lot of interesting life experiences, and so I'm really excited to have you on the podcast because the purpose of, you know, Patriot to the Core podcast is to highlight great, you know, humanitarians, great patriots, and people who just are selfless and not only love this country, but maybe show that patriotism, not only by maybe serving the country like in the military, but also by serving others, whether they're other Americans or whether they're just human beings across the world. And so you are a great example of that. You're a photography instructor by profession. I think that's how you make most of your money.
Yeah.
Working for yourself, but you also do some volunteer work, and I just wanted you to tell us about that.
Well, first let me say thank you. I'm very flattered that you would consider me such. I'm looking forward to your podcast and many of the people that I know you want to have on there. I'd be fascinated to hear, you know, their stories and the things that they do. But just thank you so much. Very honored to be on a podcast. It's, you know, it's not something a lot of people ask me about, but it kind of gives me a chance to kind of, I don't know, give an idea of what's involved in a disaster. There are some people out there who are going to be interested. There are some things that people do not know that they should know, you know, before it happens. But in regards to your question, photography, basically I teach online. I call myself Michael the Maven Online. And I have a YouTube channel under the name Michael the Mentor, and essentially I teach beginning photographers. So if they get a camera, maybe it's a Canon or a Nikon, and they've never used it, and they're struggling to learn their camera, I basically have lessons online that they can watch, and that's how I make a living. And that has been directly related to my ability to go on volunteer trips, because I can take time off from that work for, you know, weeks or even months at a time if I need to, and just set work aside and volunteer. And so the only reason I can volunteer is because of the structure of how I work. So they go hand in hand. I have a lot to be thankful for the way things ended up. I originally wanted to be a doctor, surgeon, and I was in grad school and just I was doing a PhD project. It didn't work. And I kind of had to rely on the three things that I was really good at the time, which was teaching, photography, and video. And that's when I put them together and started this business.
Yeah. And before that business, you had several other business adventures. I mean, I was there when you, not when you started a company in college, but while you were in the early days of it, when you started college here in Alabama. And I remember helping you put the stickers on the tags, you know, for brag tags. What were some of the businesses that you started?
Oh man, I have started and failed at many different businesses. That business, brag tags, that was college licensed dog tags with the logos of the school mascots on them. And I started that right at the end of my undergrad, and we would sell them for like $5 or $6 or something. But the problem with that was in order to make a profit, you had to make like hundreds of them. and then sell them at the football games. And it was, I learned a lot about business from that, but I also learned that you can have a cool business that's not necessarily profitable. You know, it was a cool product, it was a cool idea, but it didn't really make a lot of money. And so that business eventually fizzled out. I did pools, cleaned a lot of swimming pools during my time in Alabama. And after some time, I realized I should always be calculating how much money I'm making per hour with any given job. And the pool job kind of translated into wedding videography, which translated into wedding photography. And that's kind of how, you know, I was jumping around from business to business, but it all had to do with how much money I was making per hour on each of those jobs. And so some of it was just failure related, and some of it was like, you know what, I'm not making enough money for my time doing this. I'm going to try something else. So it's all good. I've learned the most from the failures in my businesses. I've had all kinds of things happen. I've made apps that we made a contract making app for photographers, and it's been ripped off, you know, 25 times within the first year of that coming out. And there's competition out there, you know, but I've kind of learned what my competitive strengths are, and I've kind of built on them, and I've been able to find a niche. And so I'm very thankful and lucky.
Yeah. And before your current business kind of really got stabilized, I mean, you had some financial struggles, didn't you?
Oh, completely. I won't go into details, but it was about as bad as it could get. You know, it was right when I was trying to finish a PhD. So I'd been 5 years into a PhD program, and I learned that my research wasn't supporting the theory I had, and my committee told me I needed to start over. That was probably the most brutal blow I took during that time, because I'd worked on it for 5 years. They said I needed to start over. Maybe I could be finished in about 3 years. And at that point I had to make a decision if I wanted to, you know, get a PhD or just quit and start working. And I had been in grad school at that time, 8 years, and I was just done, you know? And so when I quit that, I lost obviously my financial support from my scholarship that I had, and I had to move out. I was so broke at that time. I had to live with Mike Madsen, who, you know, and just out of the kindness mm-hmm. of his heart, he just let me live with him for, it was about 5 or 6 months. And that's when the business really started, is because I could focus all my time and energy on making these training videos, you know, all day, every day. I was just making training videos, and I just got lucky. I found something that worked and it stuck, and I just worked really hard at growing it. So, but yeah, I mean, it was about as bad as it could possibly get financially. I mean, I think about it now, I'm like surprised I lived through that without filing for bankruptcy.
Yeah. And I don't think I had a clue, you know, how bad it was. Obviously you weren't going around broadcasting it. We could spend a whole episode just talking about your business ventures, I think, and the ups and downs, and definitely more ups now, I believe. But I want to talk about your roles in disasters, mm-hmm. You know, what do you do? How did you get started in these relief efforts? And, you know, what countries have you volunteered in? And, you know, what do you specifically do on the ground at these disasters?
So that's a very good, these are all great questions. They're very long. I'll try to keep it to the point. Basically what happened in Haiti was after the earthquake in Haiti, and I was seeing these images of the kids crying and realizing that the aid was just too slow. I kind of felt like, here I am, a grown man, abled, healthy. I have a little bit of money, and I'm not doing anything really. I'm just working. You know, I don't have a family. I don't have kids. And so I try to look for opportunities to have a meaningful impact on society. And I just felt overwhelmed that I needed to pack my bags and go to Haiti. It was something, it would not go away. It would not leave me alone. And almost like I would be ashamed if I didn't do it. And that's what I did. I went to the store, packed my bags with camping gear and everything I thought I needed, and basically jumped on a plane without a contact in Haiti or no any plan, really. We had an idea that, you know, we could help some orphanages maybe, but we didn't know anybody there. And one of my blog subscribers, he met me in Orlando, and thank goodness traveled with me. It would have been a nightmare without him. But, you know, I think back now, it was tremendously dangerous to do that. I do not recommend people jump on a plane and go to a disaster situation without having some contacts or knowing, you know, what they're going to be doing. We sometimes refer to them as disaster tourists. Sometimes people just want to go to see the disaster firsthand, and then they turn around and leave. They're not really doing anything. And disaster tourists kind of get in the way.
Yeah.
They're a liability. You know, there's lots of chaos, and sometimes they go and they get hurt or robbed, and they become a problem, a burden on the system that's trying to help. But anyway, we went to Haiti.
You went to Haiti twice, right? So this is the first time.
This was the first time.
And is this 2010?
This is 2010, right after the earthquake.
Okay.
Within about, I think it was like, within the first week, I think we were there. So the first two or three days, I was thinking about it. And by the third or fourth day, I was packing and finally got the ticket and went. We hooked up initially with the Salvation Army. They told us to leave. They didn't want us there. And half of the people that I had kind of met on the way, they left. And I just kind of decided to stay and help these orphanages. And through time, I was able to earn the trust of the Salvation Army and eventually started working with them. And that's kind of how it got started. I was there for 3 weeks, and what we would do was we'd go out and we'd find orphanages that were not getting help, GPS tag their location, and do something called an assessment. It's where you find out how many people they have, what do they need, you know, who's in charge. But the important thing was, as I was GPS tagging the location, so we knew exactly where it was, even if there wasn't a street address, and I was taking pictures. And so when I brought the pictures back and I was showing the Salvation Army, I had proof that I wasn't, you know, there as a disaster tourist. I was there to actually help, and I was a hard worker. And that's when they started saying, okay, well, we're not supposed to do this, but we're going to give you some food you can take out to them, or we're going to give you some tents. And so we found ourselves sneaking food and tents out, you know, sometimes at night in Haiti, which is a really bad idea because there's a lot of riots, there's a lot of looting, there's people, you know, there were some aid workers who were killed. But what I do now essentially is I go out as a scout. So when there's a really, really bad disaster, typically there needs to be about 1,000 people. I'm just ballparking this. About 1,000 people dead within 24 hours is a pretty good indicator to me that it's time to go. I'm in contact with the Salvation Army, and I have my own aid group, which is called Red Lightning, but I work a lot with the Salvation Army because they have tremendous resources, very knowledgeable, they're trained, they know what they're doing, and so I usually go in with their disaster team. You know, I'm stationed in basically Hawaii, and so when something bad happens, I start communicating with the International Disaster Aid Responder, the lead, and we make a decision whether or not we're going to go in or not. But anyway, what I do, my basic specialty is to find pockets of people who are not getting aid. So what happens is, you know, in the cities, it's easy to find people who need help. But what about the people who live out in the hills or the mountains or on a different island, you know, hiking 10 hours or whatever it is to find these people? So my job is to find these pockets of smaller sized cities and groups, to GPS tag them, to assess their needs, what they need, you know, how to get it to them, try to figure out a pipeline to get the aid to them. And that's basically what I do, is I'm a disaster aid scout. That's pretty much it.
So, and Mike, you're a physically fit guy. You're, you know, you're well above the average size male, and you know, you speak with authority, you act like you know what you're doing. So, you know, I think you've been mistaken. People there think you are an official authority. Mm-hmm. Some of them think you're military. I mean, really, what's your interaction like with the locals, and how do they and the official disaster aid folks kind of receive you and treat you?
Well, initially it was as an outsider. This guy doesn't know what he's doing, you know, Salvation Army. But I think now I've learned that basically when a disaster hits, the majority of the people who have lived through it are going to have a victim mentality. Okay, like, I have suffered. And many of them have. Most of them have. Where their homes are gone, or loved ones are dead, or they're injured, or they're penniless. And so the victim role is something that happens a lot in disasters, is that you have people who have lost nothing who still think they're the victims. It's really fascinating. There is always a group of people. I don't know. I think everybody in a disaster zone, they go through this transition from being a victim to being, I'm going to take care of myself. But it's that some individuals make that transition very early on, and they become the leaders, you know, of the group. What I try to do is work with a local, if we're with the Salvation Army, they have usually a local Salvation Army church or whatnot. But in some cases, like the Philippines and Japan, we didn't have those contacts and connections. And so I tried to find the local leader who was taking charge and basically mentor him or her in what they need to do in the disaster response. I'd be like their advisor, their consultant, you know. So in Japan, there was a group who had all the resources but no experience in disaster aid. And so I basically said, this is how you should do it, and this is where you can get this, and this is, you know, the process. And eventually, you know, they developed. It's fascinating to watch these individuals accept the role of being a leader. And then it's just, how far do you want to take this? There is unlimited opportunities to do good in a disaster zone. And that's super encouraging, because in business, you know, sometimes you fail and sometimes you make it. You know, in social relationships, sometimes there's problems, or, you know, sometimes your sports team loses or whatever it is. But the beauty of a disaster is, if you go there with the intention of helping, you absolutely positively will be successful, you know, and there is unlimited opportunity for that kind of service, is to help people. So that's what it, you know, every time I go, I, you know, something will happen or I'll do something new. And I say to myself, okay, how far can I take, how much good can we do here? What's the biggest impact? And there are opportunities for those leaders to step up and take charge and say, okay, well, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and we're going to move 12 tons of food here, and we're going to do it by truck or by boat or by carrying it. And it's super, it's thrilling to be in those kinds of situations. It is. That's the best way I can describe it. It's just thrilling.
Well, and you captured a lot of these experiences in your book, 3 Weeks in Haiti. It's available on Amazon. I've read it. I read it shortly after it came out a few years ago. Actually, I guess it came out around 2011. Is that right?
Yeah, it took some time for me to actually get around to writing it. Yeah, it was about a year and a half later, something like that.
Okay. Well, I mean, one thing that you do, a topic you capture in that book, is the dangers that you experience in Haiti. I mean, so I'd like to talk about the dangers, and maybe in Haiti, maybe in other countries too, other places that you've been. What did you encounter, and, you know, how threatened did you feel? You know, all that interesting stuff.
Every disaster I have gone to, I have nearly lost my life doing something. In Haiti, we were coming back from a delivery late at night, and there was martial law at the time. It was like 10 or 10:30, and we got pulled over by a Haitian SWAT team. And they basically lined us up, you know, with machine guns and everything. And I was kind of hiding in the back of the truck. We had this little beat up truck, and the drivers were swearing we were on a disaster aid thing, and they wanted to see me, and they brought me out. And to have somebody point a machine gun right at your head, it really commands your attention, you know. So that was one time we were pretty nervous. They had killed some guys, that Haitian SWAT team, for whatever reason. Maybe they were looters, I don't know. But we were real nervous then. We had a drug dealer jump in the back one night. We shouldn't even been driving around at night, but, you know, sometimes it was the only way to get things done. And this guy was smuggling drugs around, and he wouldn't get out of our truck. You know, we were unarmed. That was pretty nerve-wracking. I was worried about the radiation in Japan, you know, the fallout, and I had to like look on maps to see which way the cloud was blowing to avoid it. And eventually had a radiation detector come in, and I'd wear this thing. And in the Philippines, I was super dehydrated. I had to have an IV for about 3 days. Man, that was terrible. That was like the worst. Actually, Vanuatu, I didn't really run into too much trouble there in terms of danger, but I was told by the locals that 100 years earlier they were cannibals, And there were stories in their culture of eating missionaries. And then in Nepal, I posted that video on YouTube of the second earthquake. We were out maybe 10 miles away from that epicenter and hiking in these Himalayan mountains, basically. And the mountains started coming down. And that was we had been dropped off earlier in the morning, by helicopter. So there was no easy way out of there. It's the helicopter drops you off and they say, okay, be at this GPS coordinate in 10 hours kind of thing, And we just lucked out. We just got lucky to be on this one hill where the other mountains were having landslides. And we just so happened to be on the right hill at the right time,
That was incredible footage. You actually captured that on video. You posted it on your website.
Yeah.
Viewers or listeners, you need to watch that video, Mike. I mean, that was really good.
The video is called Landslides in Sindapalchuk. Sindapalchuk's the area that we were working in. I was really scared then because the Himalayan mountains are relatively young. And so landslides are common out there. But the area that we were in, there are landslides all the time. There's a whole city that was gone. Basically, mountain fell on this whole city, 500 people dead. They never found the bodies. And there's stories of this guy who was in his truck and he was texting his friends. He had been, hitting a landslide. They couldn't find the guy, never found him. And we weren't sure if the hill that we were standing on was going to fall away any second. That's kind of the feeling, you feel like you're on a giant landmine that's about to explode. But when the helicopter came, we were ready to kiss it, to get the heck out of there. But that was a very stressful day, but otherwise interesting. I feel somewhat protected while I'm out there, while I'm working, but I know that if something bad happens to me, it was doing a good thing, and I can live with that. I've made my peace with that if it were to happen. So. Yeah.
So what would you say is really your motivation for doing this volunteer work?
Fulfillment to serve. It's somewhat kind of selfish, I guess, but I feel most relevant serving my fellow man. The daily grind it's very unsatisfying to me personally, making money and working and eating and sleeping, that's very low level satisfaction for me. But when you go into an area that hasn't, that they've been hit with a disaster and they're suffering, and you come in and you can help them and they're grateful to see you and they're crying, or maybe, you might medevac somebody out there that saves their life, that is very fulfilling, and you feel very relevant and important. And that's where a lot of it comes from. I can't personally do that for extended periods of time because I burn out. I last about 3 weeks and then I physically just, I run out of energy. I run out of steam. But if I could do it full time, I would do it full time, all the time. It's just very fulfilling. Wonderful.
Wow. Well, I can't remember if it was Haiti. Or where was this? Or Japan, Mike, when you were there when a man was rescued from the rubble? He had been living, he'd been buried for a few weeks. Why don't you share that and then how CNN picked up your image and, how it got blasted across the world instantly and, how he lived and your connection with him now?
So at the end of Haiti, so I was in Haiti for about 3 weeks and I got there it was within the first week. So 4 weeks after the earthquake, we were staying at this hospital. We would sleep in one of the rooms, and there was a large crowd that had gathered downstairs, and I went down to see what was happening because sometimes these little riots would break out, and so I'd kind of like shoo everybody away or whatnot. But there was somebody they had just brought out of the rubble, right from the market right around the corner. So this is 28 days after the earthquake, and they bring this guy in who's alive. And apparently he had been buried in the rubble for 4 weeks. And, you're not sure to believe this or not, but he was so emaciated. I mean, he was just completely like skin and bones, And so I took a picture of him. I took one picture on my cell phone and I sent it to my assistant. And I said, post this on the blog and post this on my CNN iReport. They're saying this guy is still alive. You know, they just brought him in and he lived in the rubble for 4 weeks. So initially, CNN has this thing called iReport where people can report events and whatnot. And CNN saw it and they called me and they're like, are you sure, you know, this is what you saw? And I said, yeah, I think this is real. We sent him to another hospital, but they rushed some people over to that hospital and verified with the doctors. And the doctors said that they believed it was true. And they did more research and they found out that it was true, that this guy had found a way to survive for 4 weeks buried under all this rubble, and somebody just so happened to find him when they were cleaning up the market. He essentially had a little trickle, a little stream of sewage water that was kind of flowing down by his body, and he would take his hand and dip it in there and lick the sewage water, and that's how the guy survived. Incredible will to survive. You know, he's basically in a coffin. He had no traumatic injuries that, you know, bone crushing or infections or anything like that. His skin had started kind of wearing off, but otherwise he was in pretty good health. But he had to undergo psychological treatment. Last I heard, he was delirious. He described being delirious, you know, through the ordeal and stuff. But his name was, I think he got confusion on last name, Evan Monsgrace, I think it was. I haven't heard much about him for a while, but I know he's alive and he's recovered.
Wow. Would you say that's the most important thing you've witnessed in all of your volunteer work?
I think that's probably the most amazing thing I've seen in terms of like a miracle. I think that's pretty, it's ranks up there. I've never seen anything like that.
What else? What is another amazing, you know, act you've witnessed while being out there?
I think probably the most crazy thing, coincidence wise, we went down to help with Hurricanes Ivan and Katrina. I don't know if you remember this story. Ivan hit. We went down to Pensacola to help clean up just with a church group, and we basically helped this family clean up their yard, and they were just desperate for help. So we helped them out and we went home. Didn't think a whole lot of it. And then Katrina hit, and we went to this is a year later. We went to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And we was working on a house, and sure enough, this guy in his truck pulls up and he gets out and he's just couldn't believe what he was seeing. And it was the man from Pensacola. And Hattiesburg and Pensacola are very far apart from each other.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And so what had happened was when the second hurricane hit, he remembered that we had helped him, and he figured that people in Hattiesburg, Mississippi needed help. And he decided to get in his truck and drive up and felt like he needed to turn down a certain road. And there we were, the same people who had helped him. I mean, the chances of a coincidence like that are just insane. And it's sort of like I saw that as kind of like proof that even a little bit of help matters and it has impact on people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that is incredible.
That was crazy. But a lot of the stuff that we do is just, it's really just simple grinding hard work. You know, it may be unloading 3 tons of food off of a truck, you know, and that's going to feed a group. I think it was amazing when I went to the Philippines. A bunch of my friends raised a lot of money, and we bought some food and fed basically a town up there for a month. That was amazing to me. You know, it may not seem as miraculous, but that to me is a miracle to be able to reach out and help somebody. I don't know.
Definitely. What about Nepal? Nepal was your most recent trip. Is that right?
That's right. About a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what were some of the best experiences and also the most dangerous experiences there? And actually, I think you may have shared the most dangerous, but maybe there's another one. And then some of the, you know, the friendships made.
Sure. I try to hook up with a translator everywhere I go, usually a local person. So I develop very close relationships with this interpreter. It's always a younger guy, anywhere from 25 to 35, speaks English, knows the culture, knows that he speaks perfect English, you know, in perfect native language, and they become my right-hand man. I've developed great relationships with all of those, each one of them. Nepal was hard because the country had limited helicopters in the beginning. And so when I first got there, we had to make a decision on whether or not to hike up to these mountains where we heard these villages were. That was pretty, for me, it was kind of scary because nobody was going up there. And we had to drive out there and then hike up there over a period of three or four days. And that was exciting and scary, but in the end, it turned out to be so worth it. And on that hike, there was a crippled man, you know, just kind of sleeping on the road next to this little path that would go up the mountain. And nobody was taking care of him. He had a little bottle of water, but he was physically living in his filth. Nobody was washing him. Nobody was taking care of him. Well, anyway, we walked past him on the way up, and then 2 or 3 days later, we come down, and he hadn't moved an inch. You know, he was still there and clearly suffering, you know. And so I could not stop thinking about this guy. How can we help this guy? You know, nobody's helping him. And so we did some research, and we asked around and found out that his brother had supposed to be taking care of him. And long story short, we went out and cleaned this guy, gave him a bath, found his brother, and told him, if you don't take care of your brother, we're going to come find you, you know. And it didn't feel like it was enough. You know, it's like, what can we do for this guy? You know, he's in an area where there's landslides. He's not really being fed. He's miserable. And long story short, through my aid organization, we raised some money and found a care center for him in Kathmandu. And then through the other aid organizations like Salvation Army and, you know, the Fishtail Air, the helicopter company that we were working with, arranged to have this guy evacuated. And I've posted that on YouTube as well. This guy's evacuation, and his name's Gokul. Found him a home. He's still in the home to this day. He's getting his care. He's being taken care of. He's being looked at, and he can stay there. I've told him we will support him as long as he needs that care. And if he wants to go back, we'll take him back, you know, but as far as I know, he's pretty happy, you know, he's eating, and that was very rewarding.
Yeah. I mean, dang. See, folks, I mean, here's what's really a seemingly ordinary guy. Mike, I met him in college, and you know, just look what you do. I mean, you're touching, really, it's one life at a time, but, you know, that is going to spread, and they'll, you know, touch their kids, or they'll be able to have children. And I mean, it's great work you're doing. So I love the stories and then reading, you know, 3 weeks in Haiti, I think, I encourage the readers to read that, because you're actually going to learn some very practical skills about how to prepare for disasters. And then you're going to learn things about friendship, and then the struggles you went through, and all the red tape, and, mm-hmm. you know, yada, yada, all kinds of stuff.
Crazy.
So maybe on a lighter side, what's the longest you've gone without a shower?
It was probably like a real shower. I think it's 10 days. And that was in Haiti. And the problem with Haiti was that it's very hot and humid, and you're constantly sweating. So 10 days of sweating without a shower. And so it was really, I mean, after the second and third day, you can kind of smell yourself stink, you know. After the fourth and fifth day, it's just so overwhelming you can't smell it anymore. It just, it's very strange. But I was filthy, filthy. And one of the Salvation Army guys, who I later became like one of my really good friends, Craig Arnold, he was staying in a hotel, fortunately for him, and he said, look, come take a shower at my place. And so I took a shower, but even after coming home from Haiti for weeks, the dirt was still coming off. Haiti's a dirty place. It's just a lot of dirt, a lot of dust. You know, it's part of it. Hey, I wanted to tell you this other story. I don't know if you got time for it.
Yeah, go for it.
A couple thoughts that came to mind was that I think in general people might doubt how much good one person can do. And that was kind of a theme in 3 weeks in Haiti was I had some doubts in terms of like, what can I do? You know, what kind of impact can I have? And in that book, we talk about that girl who would have died if we didn't, you know, find that orphanage and connect her with somebody. And so when you save somebody's life or you alleviate their suffering, it really is proof to you that one person can have a huge impact, you know, for good. And another example of this was in Japan. We had pulled over on the side of the road and there was a family sitting there going through the rubble, you know, their home, and they were kind of like huddled up together. And we started talking to them and they were just miserable. You know, the government wasn't going to help him. They lost everything. He was a fisherman. He lost his boat. They didn't have any income. And we decided to focus on this one family. So sometimes, you know, in the disaster aid world, you're supposed to help everybody equally, you know, without any hesitation in regards to their age, their race, their religion. The aid is available to everybody, you know. That's how it's supposed to go on an international UN level. But sometimes there are these opportunities to help specific individuals, you know. And so we just decided we're going to help this guy. You know, we're going to help him out. So what we did is we just spent like a week. We would go out and help him clean and, you know, we help him get a new boat. And long story short, when we had found – he told us this later. When we had found him, his family, as a family, they were discussing how they were going to kill themselves honorably.
Wow.
And it was – when we told us this, we were like, what? But that comes back to this victim mentality of, you know, that's how they feel, you know, having lived through a disaster. But when you kind of help them, you know, get them going, it's like a spark. And when they get going and they're like, okay, hey, you know, these people care, they're going to help me, and they start getting their own momentum, what happens is that person starts to help his neighbor. And that neighbor helps his neighbor. And so it's a very logarithmic, you know, result where you help this one person, which in turn will result in hundreds or even thousands of people getting help because of the example that they received. You know, a stranger came and helped me. This is how I should help my neighbor, you know. And so that was something that had come to mind. I've seen that many times, is when the victim makes the transition to leader and they just start going out. You know, the guy that I worked with in Nepal, his name's Pradeep, he's still going out and doing service on his own. This is something he, you know, no one's telling him to do it or he's not getting paid for it, but it's just very contagious, you know, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's a great point. I guess I'd never thought about that, and you just illustrated it, you know, with a guy that from Pensacola that went to Hattiesburg, mm-hmm. and then this other guy. So, yeah, I guess that's happened multiple times, and many times that you don't even know.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's the case, but it's happened enough to me that I know, even, you know, in the United States, not even during a disaster, if you know somebody that truly needs help. That's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you're able to help that person, it can have a very transmorbid, you know, it can really change them. It can change you. And you should never doubt the amount of power that comes from helping somebody who really needs it. In disasters, that is a very touchy thing because you're going to have – hundreds of thousands of people that all need help, and some need it more than others. So you might have somebody who's living in a shelter, who's lost his home. He doesn't have any clothes, but when you compare him to the guy living in the rubble, he's a king. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so even from day to day, it changes. Who needs what more? And you have to use very wise judgment in terms of who gets the help and who doesn't. And it can cause problems sometimes, bottlenecks and anyway, that's a whole other story. But anyway.
You know, I know I've lived through a pretty bad disaster, and that was Tuscaloosa 2011, April 27th. And it was a pretty bad scene. I mean, for my neck of the woods, my part of town didn't get touched. But, you know, as the crow flies, just a couple miles, I mean, it was just a war zone. And you and I talked the day after that happened, and And you said, should I come? And I remember, I think I remember telling you, I don't think so, Mike. I mean, it seems very well organized. And obviously, we weren't dealing with thousands of lives lost. I don't remember how many deaths there were. But there were definitely some deaths, and it was a horrible, horrible scene. But I think the city really responded well. And, you know, you see that sometimes, you know, the flooding in Nashville several years ago. I mean, some cities respond well, and people don't play the victim mentality. But there's also sometimes people that genuinely need help. And there's sometimes there's people that are just sitting back saying, okay, government, what are you going to do? And when are you going to help me?
Yeah. Tuscaloosa was hard for me to make a decision on because I'd lived there for 9 years. I had a lot of friends there. But I kind of looked at the situation and knew that there were enough access points and enough people that could get there. And also the expense of doing these trips, it's very expensive to do. You know, I pay for this out of my own pocket up until Nepal, and it's a little bit of annual. I had a little bit of donations, but it was a matter of a little bit of expense and also knowing that there was enough resources getting to Tuscaloosa that made me say, okay, maybe this is something I could probably not go to. I burn out very quickly in disasters, so after about 3 weeks, I become ineffective. I lose the ability to talk at some points because I'm so tired. And other people, you know, that the Salvation Army brings in, they're kind of like slow burners. They'll be good for 8 or 12 weeks. It's just, you know, how, I don't know. It has to do something with their intensity, the intensity of the person. But I'm very good at the start of it. You know, when things are chaotic and there's a lot of pressure, I'm really, really good for 3 weeks and then I'm done. But Tuscaloosa, you know, in the United States, we have a lot of very well-organized groups from churches to fire departments to police departments from other areas that are more than willing to get in their cars and drive. And that's what we've seen with Katrina. We saw it with 9/11. We've seen it with lots of disasters. I don't want to sound biased or anything, but Americans are really good at stepping up to the plate. They really are. Other countries, maybe not as much, you know, but when we were in the Philippines, I love Filipinos, by the way. They're some of the nicest, kindest, coolest people you will ever meet. But there's something about an American coming into the Philippines. I think it has to do with General MacArthur, you know, when he helped liberate them from Japan. But they really listened to me. You know, they would organize if I told them, but if I didn't tell them, it was maybe not as clear, you know, but once they were told, they would know how to do it. But I guess that's the thing is I'm coming back to is there's always these victims. And I think about this one guy in the Philippines, grown man, completely healthy, no injuries. And we're like, hey, we need you to come help us unload this truck. And he's just like, I can't, I'm a victim. It was crazy to me. You know, he had just decided that what are you going to do for me? And there are people who will, I hate to say this, they're predatory in disaster situations. In Pensacola, there were groups going down there gouging the victims for tree removal. So trees fall over on the houses. How do you get the tree off the house? Well, this company shows up and says, we'll take a tree off your house for $5,000 each. And there's so many houses that have this problem that you have to pay them the money if you want to clean up your yard. And so we see a lot of this victimization where people are saying, I am a victim, you must help me. And there's also people who go and prey on them saying, look, you know, if you want your house to not leak water, it's going to be $20,000 to fix your roof. They have no choice just because of supply and demand. The demand is so high, there's no one else that'll do it. So we see both sides of that. And, I think the people who do best in disaster situations are the ones who have accepted the role of taking care of themselves. They've accepted that before it's happened. And the ones who do the worst are the ones who sit back and wait for somebody to come help them.
Wow. Yeah, that's great insight. Life lessons there. I agree with that. So really, what aspects of disasters do you feel that victims in general are most unprepared for? And what's the best advice you can give them to avoid it?
I think taking on, okay, so what in the United States, and this is something I've tried to talk to friend, I've talked to you about it, is that we don't, society doesn't understand how fragile we are, okay? Because if a major disaster happens, 911 is not coming to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if something happens within 30 minutes, all of our services, police department, fire department, ambulances, 911, they are not coming to help you. If it's bad enough, you are on your own. That is probably psychologically the biggest problem as that we have in the States, is because we have a very good response program in 911 and ambulances and getting aid out. And if something's wrong, you know, you can call the cops and they'll be there. That's not going to happen in a disaster. If a disaster happens, you are not going to be able to get in your car and drive to the gas station. Why? Because there's going to be a line from here, you know, for miles away. You may not even be able to get on the road. And so that's something that I think in the States we're most unprepared for, is that we don't know what's coming. And when it does come, we're not going to be ready for it.
Yeah, I agree. What are the most important preparation items that we can have?
There's a few things that come to mind. The first thing is that you have to accept that you alone are responsible for yourself and your family. The police are not responsible for you. The ambulance is not responsible for you. Those are tools that our society has given us to kind of help. But in the end, you have to be self-reliant. You know, if somebody's breaking into your house, it's not the cop's responsibility to come and save you. You know, that's like the secondary plan. It's your responsibility to take care of yourself. You know, call the cops, get them there as fast as you can, but they may not be there for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes. What are you going to do in the meantime? You know, so that first mentality is that you are responsible for yourself is the first thing. The second thing is to have many plans for what will go wrong, whether you're going to stay or whether you are going to flee, depending on the disaster. So have a plan to stay, have a plan to defend your home with violence if necessary, have a plan to escape, not by car, and have resources like a generator. Electricity is something that's going to be taken away in a disaster. You're going to lose power. It's another thing that we're kind of spoiled with. So how will you generate power? How will you get clean water? I think families should have some sort of storage, at least enough for everybody for a week minimum. But the most important single item a family or a parent can have in their home in case of a disaster is a firearm, a gun. And sometimes people are surprised when I say that, but what happens is, and we saw this in Katrina, was within 24 hours of you know, social services breaking down, there's armed looting, which means someone could come home to home, door to door, and rob you blind because the cops are not going to come to protect you. So I always tell people the first thing you should have is probably a pistol. I'm a fan of a Glock 19. You can use that for home defense. You can carry it on your person just for self-defense of your family, your home. That's going to be the most important thing because, you know, you just don't know what you're going to meet person-wise in a disaster. So have a gun, know how to use it, teach everybody in the family who's competent and able to use it. And then the second thing I would say is have a means to escape not related to your car, something like a bike or a horse. I know horses aren't really an easy thing to maintain. That's in a disaster, a horse is the ultimate form of transportation. It really is. But I think a bicycle is a really good idea to have around your home because you can really ride a bike for, you know, 50-100 miles, and that would get you out of the situation if the roads are blocked or if there's no gas or something of that nature. The thing with preparing is you can prepare for everything and still not be ready. I consider myself very prepared, and I know that I'm still not ready for what might happen, you know? But at least I have some plans. At least I have some tools to help me and some ideas. But yeah, if you stay and defend, have a weapon, preferably one for each person in the house. Have a way to get electricity, whether it's through generators or solar power. Have an alternate source for water, and have some sort of food storage if you decide to stay. And then if you decide to leave, if you can get away in your car, great. If not, have a bike. That's probably some of the best advice I can give people right there.
That's good. And I mean, this is not far-fetched. I mean, we've seen these things happen, and you've lived through them many times, Mike, as a volunteer. And I guess, have you lived through a natural disaster maybe as an initial victim?
Are you asking me, have I lived through
one? Yeah.
I mean, I've been in aftershocks, you know, so I'm very familiar with what an earthquake feels like. And I've probably been through, this is going to sound crazy, 20 something plus earthquakes or aftershocks. I haven't been in an actual disaster that I was actually suffered from it, but I think the mentality is pretty applicable that you just decide you're not going to be a victim. And if there's a disaster and there's a tremendous opportunity to do good, nothing can stop you.
Yeah.
You know? So I think once somebody has accepted that, no, you can't rely on the police or whoever to come save you, that's a great place to start. You know, and I, some people are upset when I tell them to own a firearm, and, you know, they should be trained with it, but really, you can't see what's coming, and you don't know when it's going to come. And that's the one thing that you're really going to wish you wanted to have if you didn't plan for it. Everything else you might be able to get after, you know, but a gun. I've wanted to have a gun, you know, when that drug dealer jumped in the back of our truck with us, I desperately wanted one, you know, and to have that feeling of wanting a gun and not having one, it's a sense of helplessness, you know, that you can't defend yourself, or to have somebody trying to beat your door down and you can't defend yourself. It's it's a terrifying feeling if you don't have something like that to do it. So I emphasize that. I like the Glock 19s because they're high capacity. They're easy. They don't malfunction. They're very tough. You can throw them in the mud and they're going to work. And, it's a good gun to shoot, but I also say you should be trained on it. If you're a homeowner and you don't own a gun, I think you're crazy. You know, I do. Yeah. I think that's just insanity. Everybody should have a gun that is able mentally and physically to operate it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you hope you never have to use it. But
exactly.
I've got one. I'm ready. In fact, a Glock 19 is my weapon of choice. My top weapon of choice. And so I hope that if the need ever arises, that I don't hesitate. But I will, because I want to take care of my family. I will protect my family. I've got small kids and a wife. You have a go bag, and so you're ready 24/7. You have to be. It would mean you'd be hypocritical if you weren't, given your business. I mean, so what are some things in your go bag? And also, particularly, what about your clothes, too? Because you talked about, you know, sweating a lot, going many days without showering. So, yeah, what type of material do you wear, and what's in your bag?
So I have two go bags now. One is full of basically MREs, meal ready to eat. Those are the military meals. They have about a 7-year shelf life. Can be as much as 50 pounds of it. And I bring just the meals to eat, because when we go into these situations, sometimes food's not readily available or the victims need it. So whenever I go in, I kind of assume that I have to take care of myself for 3 weeks. So that includes all of my clothing, all of my food. I try not to bring as much water because water is heavy, but I do bring water filters with me. So if I needed to filter water and drink, which I have had to do, in fact, in Vanuatu and in Nepal, there were several times that was the only way to go, is to filter water. You know, we were going to dehydrate. In my go bag, I have a very small two-man tent. I have a hammock that can be suspended between two trees, so I have shelter. I have three changes of clothing in a dry bag and a few extra pairs of like shirts and underwear. I'm trying to think what else I have. I have a couple knives, very particular about the knives that I bring. I have a Leatherman. I have headlamps. Satellite phone, very important. I have two different satellite phones. I usually bring both of them now. Satellite phones work anywhere in the world without, you know, internet. And so I use those constantly. I bring solar chargers to charge battery packs. So if I'm out in the jungle for a week, I have electricity for my phones, for my iPhone. I bring usually two iPhones to GPS tag and to keep notes. I use the iPhones as a camera and a video recorder. I don't bring my cameras anymore. My professional cameras I leave behind because they're just too heavy.
And I want to interrupt you a minute. Have you had any problems getting through security at airports with any of these items?
Yeah,
what do you do?
I should probably say that I do not bring guns with me. Although, if I had my choice, I would. I would definitely bring guns if I could. I can't bring them into other countries if I want to get there quickly, you know, and even then it may be impossible. But when I went to Japan, I usually have like three knives, and sometimes I'll bring like a rescuer's tool. It's sort of like an axe that has a crowbar built into it, you know, just different things. And when I went to Japan, you know, I just threw it in my bag and went. You know, it turns out all of those things are illegal in Japan, you know. I didn't know that you can't have a knife over, I think it's like 2 inches long or an inch and a half long blade. It's something stupid. And, you know, they x-ray your bags when you come in, and for whatever reason, they didn't give me any problems. And so I just went through, and I remember I dropped my knife once on a job, and somebody saw it, and it's this huge knife, you know, and the Japanese guy was freaking out. He's like, "That's illegal. You can't have that," you know, and I just smiled and put it in my pocket. But I've never had any problems in the airports bringing gear in. I just say, "Hey, here are my credentials. I'm here, you know, with Salvation Army or Red Lightning," and almost always they let me through, no problem.
Wow.
They want you there, you know. Some countries I've seen, like, I hate to say this, I probably shouldn't say, but there are some countries that will try to tax the aid responders as they come in, try to make money off of them. It's crazy. In Haiti, we sent, the Salvation Army sent a bunch, 7 containers of aid that sat in the docks for 6 months because the fees that they were being taxed was just crazy. And so sometimes we see that initially the country or the government will let aid in, and then they want to start collecting taxes on it. It's just absurd.
Wow.
There's a lot of corruption that goes on. I hate to say that, but there's, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of good, mostly good organizations, but there are some really shady things that go on that we rarely hear about, you know, in the newspapers and in public, you know, how funds are used and how donations are used and where the money goes. And all I would say is, before you donate to any group money, is to research them on a website called Charity Navigator. And that lists their financials. Take a look at their CEO. How much is the CEO paying themselves? You know, at the time in Haiti, I think the CEO of one of the biggest organizations was taking like $1.5 million, you know? So there's some different trains of thoughts on this. You know, they have to make the big salary to run a big group, but I just don't believe that. I mean, I don't take any money for what I do. There's no reason somebody should be taking $1.5 million for running a charity.
It's, yeah, right.
You know?
Well, Mike, we're running up on an hour, really close to it, and there's several more things I want to get to, and I think we can.
Okay, I'll try to keep it short. Sorry.
Well, this is very, very good information. We could actually make it 2 episodes, so I think we'll try to keep it to 1 or maybe have you back later and we can elaborate on some stuff. But how can someone get involved in disaster relief like what you do, or not even to your level?
I would say volunteering locally at even just like a soup kitchen or with their church or maybe a local organization, and tell them to pay attention to how they feel. when they're serving their fellow man. And if they feel that fire lighting, like, hey, this is really awesome, then it's something they should take to the next level and join. There's search and rescue teams that they can sign up with and join. But the problem is people want to serve the day after the disaster happens. And by then it's too late. If you want to do disaster aid work, you have to sign up and train long before the disaster happens. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
So what I would recommend is just to start off volunteering and pay attention to how you feel emotionally. And if it feels like it's something that's really, you know, something you want to do, then pursue it further. But a disaster tourist packing up and going over, unless you have special skill sets, like you're a doctor or a nurse, I would not recommend you putting yourself in danger. Do not do it.
I think that's great advice. Well, contrast how you feel when you're there serving in the thick of it versus once you're, you know, the day or two after you're home. What's the different emotions that you feel?
I feel when I'm there, I'm reminded of what blessings I have to live in the United States. And when I come back, there's usually about 2 days of decompression where I'm not really with it mentally anymore. I just kind of sleep and watch Netflix, you know, and eat. But when you come back, I mean, you have a tremendous amount of gratitude for things like running water. You know, that's something we would never think about unless it was taken away from you. But if you live in a sweaty tent for 3 weeks, you're going to really be thrilled to have hot running water or to be able to drink out of the faucet. How amazing is that? And all of the little things that typically stress you out from your job or Facebook or whatever, you know, that rattles you, it just doesn't matter. It just doesn't get to you anymore because you've seen people suffering, real suffering, you know? So it's tremendously beneficial to a person to reset kind of their soul. That's the way I look at it.
Okay. Good advice. Mike, in closing, when my little brother Mark was killed in September of 2010, I believe you were in Haiti. Is that correct?
Yep, second trip.
So tell us how you got the news about Mark, because you and he were very close. And then I'd like you to talk briefly about your, you know, making it back to Haleyville in time for the funeral, because you played a huge role there for us. You took some incredible pictures that we never would have had, and that obviously are just priceless to us to this day. So I'd like you just to touch on that, how you found out, and how you made it back in time.
I found out we were working on a project, photography video, and we had just finished a shoot, and I had gotten a text message from one of our mutual friends, Chase Layton, and he had told me, and that's how I first found out. And then you called me shortly, I mean within minutes you called me. The problem at that time was I had committed to go back to Haiti to organize a team to get these containers of aid out, and so I felt like I had to go. I couldn't tell him no, because without me there was no security team. And we talked about this, but I decided I had to do it. So went to Haiti and we organized the group. We got the containers, a lot of red tape and paperwork and scouting and stuff like that. But what had happened was I kind of felt like everything that I could have done was on its way to finishing. And it was, let me think, it was a day before his funeral. And I remember sitting in this meeting and I just told Craig, who was with me, I said, I feel like I have to go to Alabama right away. And sometimes that happens. I get these really strong impressions that I need to go somewhere or do something and I can't say no to it. And he just looked at me and he said, well, then you got to go. Got online, bought my ticket. The next morning I was on a plane, traveled all day, made it to Birmingham, got in a car, drove up. And I literally got to the funeral maybe an hour before you guys pulled up. And that was the right decision. I mean, looking back on it, I think I would have definitely regretted not going and participating. It was good for me too, because I was not in a good place emotionally after that happened with Mark. I cried for days, you know, when Mark died. And that helped a lot of my personal healing, seeing you guys and seeing how you guys were handling it and being with you. That was just very healing. So yeah, I mean, that's what happened. But you know, I miss Mark. I think about him all the time. It's been coming up on 6 years now, but you know, I just wish I could talk to him again and hang out with him. And I'm sure you miss him and your family miss him much more than I possibly could, but yeah, we love Mark.
Yeah. And so the listeners know, I mean, Mark is the reason why I started this podcast, because I've met so many people who are just great Americans. And of course I already knew you, Mike, but this is something that, so I'm not just interviewing military. There's plenty of people who didn't serve, who can't serve, whatever the reason is in the military. But I wanted to highlight people everywhere that you just normally wouldn't hear about. And you can read about Mike in Mark's book. Mike, he's labeled as Michael Andrew. Mark's book, My Brother in Arms. You really got there. I remember us, we were driving from the funeral home to the high school where the funeral was. And you were standing outside there at the corner of the school. And I remember my mom rolling down the window and saying, Mike, Mike. And she was so happy to see you. And you were out there taking pictures, I think.
Yeah.
And I think you jumped in the car with us. Is that
right?
Yeah,
I did. Yeah, I did.
You probably had stopped and bought a white shirt from Walmart. Yeah. You probably still reeked. I don't remember that, but you probably did. But man, what a great, I'm so glad you were there. And yeah, it does. It gets a little emotional just thinking about it, because you and Mark spent so much time together. And then just what you did for us with the pictures, and you stayed with my parents for a while. You went up to Pope, up to North Carolina with us. So, you saw a lot of really some intimate moments and captured them too. So really, I can't thank you enough for that.
Oh, my pleasure. My honor. Absolutely.
You are really a great American, Mike, and there's a whole other side to you that we didn't really get to see on the on here. The humor, your dating tips, all kinds of good stuff. But really, how can people find out? How can people follow you and find out more about you and more about your organization, Red Lightning? Everything about you.
All of my social media. I am Michael the Maven, whether it's Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. My website is michaelthemaven.com, and then the disaster website is Red Lightning, just the way it sounds, with no space. Redlightning.com is my aid organization, and haven't updated it for a while, but we post some of the work that we do, and we're working on some special projects I can't really get into, obviously, for different reasons, but hopefully want to have a bigger impact than what I'm doing now, and maybe it'll take 10 years, but it's something I'm working away on, and in the meantime, just getting ready for, I'm ready for the next disaster. If it happens tonight, I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, I believe that. I know that. So folks, please, if you have any questions for Mike, please contact him with the several options that he gave. He's pretty easy to find online. Also, please send me any comments or any suggestions, any questions for Mike. You can send them to me as well. But thank you for listening to Patriot to the Core. Tune in next week for another captivating interview like we've had today. And Mike, I look forward to talking to you and actually seeing you sometime soon, hopefully.
I need to get out there to see you guys. I know it's been a while. But thank you so much for having me on the show, Thad. I really appreciate it, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Great. Till next time.